This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in the studio with me. We are discussing artificial intelligence in orthopedics. So how timely is that? Welcome, Dr. Rajesh. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you, Meera.
What did you think of this? I mean, is it an exciting frontier in healthcare? Do you think it's at a very nascent stage, or do you think we're getting somewhere?
I think the impetus behind this talk really came from a literature review which I did and just published. And the title of that literature review is Artificial Intelligence Methods in the Detection of Surgical Instruments Under Ultrasound Guidance. So one of the big things which is going to change the way we do surgery is imaging. Instead of having to hack open a wall to repair a leaky pipe, you can repair the leaky pipe on the inside, provided you can navigate your way through the pipes. It's the same with heart bypass surgery, right? People used to have their chest cut open, but now with angiography, we can actually thread wires through the vessels and do it. It's very much the same with orthopedics now. There's a huge potential for image-guided orthopedic surgery. And I use ultrasound as my choice of imaging because there's no radiation, it's real-time. The disadvantage is you can't see instrumentation very clearly. So instrumentation has to be designed for the ultrasound. And what I said was, well, let's look at the problem slightly differently. Let's say we take a standard surgical instrument. How easy is it to see under the ultrasound? Well, the truth was, to the naked eye, it's very hard to see. But if you use artificial intelligence methods, the software can see it. And it's completely mind-blowing in terms of, you know, you sort of switch on the software and suddenly it's like somebody switched the lights in the room on, you can see everything. And that got me thinking, well, okay, so I know that computational power can be used to image surgical instruments. Well, that's where I started. Then I asked the question, what other areas of orthopedics is it being used for? And I think motion analysis is a really big one. And the motion analysis comes in two parts. One I would call probably social analysis, and the other one I would probably call medical analysis. Now, I'm sure you've seen this. It was in the press recently, somebody from China who was doing image recognition, right? So there's this idea that computers do facial recognition, you know, that sort of the big sell for the iPhone X and things like that. But the manufacturers have basically now put the hardware and the software together on a chip. So you can have like one of these IP cameras, you know, the one that you plug into your laptop. And it'll not only do facial recognition, it'll also do body recognition. So there's that Mission Impossible movie, Rogue Nation. There's one of those where there's a biometric security measure which looks at how a person walks. What is the proportion of their limbs? What is the proportion of chest to trunk limbs and how they move? And analyzes that as a security data print. Now, how we move is actually as unique as our fingerprints, is actually as unique as our iris. But there's lots of people reading irises, lots of people reading fingerprints, but not many people reading sort of whole body analysis. So what these guys from China have basically done is they've basically put the camera and the software required to analyze it on a chip. So you can use it for basically picking people up anywhere off the street. You know, these things that you see about this sort of utopian or dystopian societies where everybody is being monitored by cameras all the time. It's not far from reality. So that's what I would call the social analysis. Now, the medical analysis, it got me thinking because I was treating this young lady who's a professional dancer. And I treated her hand, and she was lying down on the bed. And when she got up differently to how other people get up. So other people swing their legs over the side of the bed and then, you know, hoik themselves up. This lady got up like little sort of motion segment by motion segment, like she was sort of dancing as she got up. And I thought that's very interesting. So I asked her, you know, do you have any back pain? She said no. Is it uncomfortable in the chest? She said no. And then thought about it and thought, well, obviously her pattern of movements useful, but how do I analyze that? So that's when I went to this sort of medical image analysis. And artificial intelligence basically looks at a whole bunch of different parameters that we think are important, analyzes it, and gives that information to us and say, hey, guys, what do you think?
So you've got image-guided assistance, mm-hmm. and then you've also got motion analysis, which can help you.
Yeah.
Are there any other gaps that you think AI can fill?
Okay, so if we look at decision-making, now, medical decision-making is very, very fraught with human failures. Every time a doctor has to go through a decision-making process, there's lots of factors that he has to consider. Some of those factors may not be the best influencer for that particular decision at that particular time. So a very common one is this idea called proximity of risk. So let's say that a doctor seen a patient with an extremely rare condition and he may have missed the diagnosis, for example. Now, that proximity of risk means that every other patient whom he sees, which may potentially have that diagnosis, has that diagnosis until proven otherwise. That's irrational. But because we're humans, that irrationality comes in the play of the decision-making process. Not to say that it harms patients, but it's one of those things that affects how decisions are made. Now, there's lots of algorithms that help doctors to make decisions. The challenge with algorithms is knowing when to use them and knowing when not to use them. Because at the end of the day, we are accountable for the decisions that we help our patients make. We're accountable for the advice we give. We can't say, oh, the machine told me to say that. That's obviously not going to cut mustard. So to answer your question, I think that medical decision support in terms of artificial intelligence is probably a little bit of a way off. I think image reading is just a complete no-brainer. You know, there's ample evidence that a computer program can read mammograms better than a radiologist, x-rays better, chest x-rays better than a radiologist, mass screenings better than a radiologist. The challenge with all of these situations, though, is that the problem is predefined, right? So if you, some lovely little experiments, if you give a computer the job of analyzing a series of mammograms, right? X-rays women have to look for breast cancer. And on one of those, there happens to be a foreign body in the breast. Then it completely throws the computer. The computer doesn't even pick it up. And that foreign body, which may have been, you know, a piece of shrapnel from a car accident or, you know, something which is clinically very relevant, doesn't get picked up.
Because?
Because the machine can't see it. So the machines are very good at simple repetitive tasks. The task it is that you want the machine to do, you want it to do again and again and again, but you have to define the task.
Right.
Machines are not good at deciding what to do.
So it's defined to look at abnormal cells or growths and stuff in a breast, but not exactly a foreign object, is
well,
what you're saying.
It's more the gestalt. It's more the... So let's say you take a famous painting, let's say the Klimt, Gustav Klimt. So he's got, his theme is that sort of gold modernist kind of color. Now, if you said to a human being, look around and say which is likely to be a fake and which is likely to be not be a fake, and you're walking in you walk into a shop that sells novelties, for example, the human would just say, well, every single item in the shop is fake because it's a novelty shop. Whereas the computer would have to analyze every single item in the shop and match it against a database of known pictures and do the analysis and say, are any of these fake or any of these real? So the computer cannot contextualize, whereas the human can contextualize. And that contextualization is the real difficulty for artificial intelligence in medicine, which is why, I mean, it's great in very narrow execution tasks, but not the global, you know, don't have to go see a doctor, speak to your iPhone or your Samsung kind of situations. Not likely to be too soon on the horizon.
I mean, I've always had this conversation with doctors who always ask me, you know, do you think robots and AI will take over the job of a doctor? And my answer is a flat no. Can we digitize human cognition? Can we digitize, you know, the knowledge that you have? Mm. And even if you do, to what extent, you know?
Well, let me give you the example of the young lady I just saw today. All right, so it's a little bit late because I was talking to this young lady who has what looks to be an infection on the upper arm caused by the scratch of a cat. And that's been going on for about 3 weeks. She's seen lots of different people. And she's read so much on the internet that she's completely petrified of surgery. So she says, oh, you know, what happens if you cut a nerve? Will I go numb? You know, then I reassure her about that. And then she says, well, I'm scared of pain. What will you do for the pain? I say, well, I'll give you lots of painkillers. And she goes, well, painkillers are bad for the kidney. I go, well, you know, then you can go ask Google to do your surgery. So I think it was very topical for today, because I think that the internet as we know it is helpful for some background, but cannot help you make a decision. You still need a human to help you make a decision. And not to say humans are perfect, but in healthcare, human interaction is very contextualized. So the things which I would see in healthcare in Malaysia are very different to when I go to Australia and I practice there and I see them there. It's not to say that it's not the same problem, it's the exact same problem. But the human being and the social circumstance that they have it in may even be the same. But the context of the healthcare system is not the same. And because the context of the healthcare system is not the same, what is done to and for that patient is very different.
And you can help them make that informed decision, is what you're saying.
Because I'm aware of the healthcare system. And this is one of the real killers with foreign doctors working in a country, you know, with no training in that healthcare system. I made that conscious decision when I decided to come back to Malaysia. So the choice was, if I trained overseas, if I did my final stages of surgical training overseas, then that's the healthcare system that I would, what you would say, grow up in. And so I would be deficient because I wouldn't know the local healthcare system. So I made the choice to come back to Malaysia to do my surgical training. I went overseas after that to fill the gaps in my training in, you know, the couple of things I wanted to do that I didn't feel that I had here. But the full breadth and width of the healthcare system was learned in the training years. And that's what artificial intelligence cannot tell you. Artificial intelligence will say, what are the rules? And the rules are not written rules. They're social rules, they're social norms. And lots of things are unsaid, unwritten, but understood. So all those things need to be considered.
We're discussing AI in orthopedics with Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. When we come back, we'll find out more about AI. And what's coming through a lot online is bionic limbs, very much prosthetics and AI. We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in the studio with us. We're discussing the AI frontier in orthopedics. We have, Dr. Rajesh has given us a quick overview as to where artificial intelligence is in the area of orthopedics. You see a potential in image-guided orthopedic surgery, probably happening to some stage, some extent already. You're looking at motion analysis and how that if AI is able to do that, it will help you in doing social analysis as well as medical analysis, as well as help patients make decisions when it comes to surgery. And you know, you've also mentioned that computers cannot contextualize, and hence the reason why doctors will help in that area. You know, we do know that, you know, we've got AI for oncology, for an example, to help with diagnosis and stuff. But as you said, it's just about doctors putting in information into a system, and then if you key in a similar situation, then the machine picks up possible solutions, and then it's your decision as to how you want to run with it. Yeah. But do you see, is there something already for orthopedics? Or what's in existence for orthopedics at the moment as far as AI is concerned?
In terms of surgery, well, there's probably some decision support, right? So the decision of, let's say, for example, if you want to take it to 3D implant printing. So 3D implant printing, before you can decide how you want to model a particular implant to be printed or to be made, you need some AI. There's some AI in terms of deformity correction. So let's say somebody has a bone that's broken and healed, bent, and that bone needs to be straightened. There's a series of very clever equipment that allows us to plan the surgery in a not very brutal way. So we can do things quite cleverly by cutting the bones in the correct position mm-hmm. before we reposition them, but not it's sort of deconstructing the whole thing and reconstructing it. And that requires, I'm not sure I would call them AI, because there's no intelligence involved. It is probably just heavy-duty computational mathematics that's done very quickly over the internet now. So I can do over the internet and sort of a normal internet connection what would have taken in a few minutes, what would have taken a supercomputer years to do. So that's probably more brute force rather than intelligence. I think in terms of intelligence in orthopedics, there's some research going on to looking at understanding mechanisms of injury. So one of the fascinating ones, which is subject of somebody's PhD, was there's a tendon called the hamstrings tendon that's at the back of the thigh. And that tendon is injured, but not in a way that we can understand biomechanically now. Clearly, that certain things you say, well, you know, that's pretty obvious why that should be injured. But with the hamstrings, it's not clear why it should be injured. And what this group basically did was, with image capture motion analysis, they said, okay, well, how we understand the function of this muscle is incorrect. And with this new understanding that we've got, we can explain to you why is it that the hamstrings tendon gets injured at exactly that point. Which then says, well, we can use that to explain what you can do to prevent those injuries. And I think the future will really be explaining things that don't really make a lot of sense in orthopedics now. So one of the things that vexed me from when I was a trainee is this thing called the shoulder spur. Now, the idea is that there's a piece of bone which, when you look at a young population, everybody's bone is flat. If you look at the population as it ages, more people get a hook on the bone. So to me, just knowing the basic biological laws of orthopedics, that doesn't really make a lot of sense, because bones shape two forces. If a bone forms a hook, the question that you should be asking is not what is the hook or where is the hook or what is the shape of the hook or how big it is, which is the questions we're asking now. But you should be asking the question, why did the hook form? Now, clinically, I have a reasonable idea why the hook forms, because I look at patients and I go, okay, I can see a hook. And on the ultrasound, I can see the rotator cuff tendon, and they're both there, but they don't have any relationship. But when the patient moves, then I look at it and I go, well, you know, this ball and socket joints migrated up. So since it's migrated up, when you put force, it must be pushing up against the bone. And that rubbing must be reshaping the bone to form the hook. But that's anecdotal, because you know I can demonstrate that in a series of patients. But I don't have the computational power to describe that biomechanically. I can draw models on pieces of paper. But to be able to describe that in terms of computational science and say, here's me proving to you clearly biomechanically with the same rules which are available everywhere else, why is it that this occurs? So in our treatment of the patients then, we should really be looking at stabilizing the shoulder blade. And this is very interesting. I sort of came to this analogy quite recently. People talk about shoulder pain like a crane. So you have a crane and then there's the boom of the crane that moves around. And how the relationship between the two parts is not normal. I said, well, okay, let's take that relationship, but let's assume that the crane is now on a ship. And if you have a ship that's tilted, then obviously the crane's not going to function well. So you have to correct the tilt of the ship which is basically the position of the shoulder blade, before the crane can function well. And I finally got some physiotherapists who sit with me in the clinic. So we see the patients together. They see the history, the examination, the ultrasound findings. Sometimes if they have the stomach for it, they go in for the procedure as well. But it's really been revolutionary because the physiotherapists are saying, you know, doc, we've been suspecting this for the longest time, but nobody's been telling us it. So it's lovely to be able to work with well-experienced physiotherapists who are seeing things day in, day out, who are thinking and going, this doesn't make sense. So to answer your question, the future is in helping, the future for artificial intelligence in orthopedics is to help us understand the fundamental biomechanics of what it is that happens. And then for us to explain to people, well, anecdotally as a clinician, this is how I fix problems. So can we look at this from a systems perspective and say, what can we change? For example, ergonomically, in terms of how we design desks, how we design computers, how we design chairs, how we design car seats to address those issues. And I think that's where the translation is going to be. The translation's not going to be from a big lab down to the end user. I think it's probably going to be from groups of people like myself around the world going, hey, I see the same thing, you know, which is what science is. Fundamentally, when we do research to improve the care of our patients. Before the age of the internet, there were groups of researchers around the world or clinicians like myself who would say, here's a series of cases that I've seen. Then somebody else from somewhere else in the world would say, here's a series of cases that I've seen. And so that sort of case series was the first sharing of knowledge. Then came systematized science, which is the more basic science version where we publish the basic science of what it is that has happened in journals. And I think that that's probably gone a little bit too far. This sharing of clinical case knowledge is deemed to be the least valuable on the scientific hierarchy. But from the patient perspective, I think it's actually the most valuable. That, you know, hey guys, I've seen a couple of these. This is what I did. This is what happened. This is what I think is going on. What have you seen? What do you think? So that level of sharing now has almost gone to social media level, which is very unfortunate because then you get the shouters, people who sort of do one thing, stand up on a soapbox and yell, I'm the greatest, versus somebody else who's done 100 and goes, oh, you know, I've got this little niggling suspicion.
But then that's research, isn't it? That's what it's there for, yeah, for you to, you know, question. And
it is, but I think we need a medium somewhere between the academic journals and Facebook. something in between, which at the minute is just looking like professional collaborative networks.
Yeah, and then but then again, you don't blame them. The very few platforms that communicate science to the public, really, and well, social media has come to bridge that gap, and so unfortunately, it's nothing else in between.
Well, so there is the bigger picture. BFM.
Yes. So here it is. You just threw out something like the oncology system, which exactly what you have described as sharing of knowledge and not terribly valuable.
Okay. The thing about the oncology system is it's, again, very, very contextual. Now, let's look at what do you do to treat cancers, you give people, well, firstly, for diagnosis, I think it's very valuable, right? Somebody has a weird and wonderful, and they go off onto the internet, and there's a weird and wonderful support group, and they say, hey, look, send us our slides, we've got an interest group in this, and we'll give you your diagnosis, that's fine. You know, I've had a couple of patients who have actually had diagnosis from Stanford, Mayo, a couple of places in the UK. But these are like the super weird and super wonderfuls, you know, one in 5 years, one in 10 years, not the 10 a day. So when you come to oncology, diagnosis, without a doubt, the problem with treatment is Dr. Google going to give you your chemotherapy? Because simple things, certain chemotherapy drugs, for example, even in the US, are very expensive. So I know of patients who fly to India to buy their chemotherapy medication, have their chemotherapy, and fly back to the US because it's cheaper than getting treated in the US. If they're not insured, somebody's got to pay for their treatment. And if the government's not paying for it, they're paying for it. They want the most cost-effective solution. So the thing about cancer treatments is who's monitoring you, what access of drugs do you have, what's the legal and regulatory framework, all of these things which artificial intelligence cannot address. In those situations, social intelligence actually addresses it because there'll be support groups. There'll be people to say, you know, hey guys, I'm taking a plane to India. I'm going to buy these medications. Hands up, who wants to buy some? And then, you know, they get together and they buy their medication, which I think is good. I think that empowering people to take control of their health is very, very important. I don't think that health should be institutionalized. I think health is provided for through institutions. But for institutions to control an individual's health somehow just seems wrong. People live. People make decisions about what they eat, what they drink, what jobs they do, what car they drive, where they go, how they lead their lives. All of these have institutional influences. So obviously, if you're 14, you can't ride a motorcycle because the law says you can't. Obviously, if you're drunk and you're driving a car, there are laws against it. But I call these institutional guidance. Whereas for healthcare, it's still very much in the institution. You go to a hospital for healthcare. If you don't go to the hospital, you don't get healthcare. So the delivery model for healthcare, in my opinion, needs to be a little bit decentralized, needs to be a little bit more community-based, which is fine for primary healthcare. But when you get to specialist healthcare, it then gets to be a bit difficult because you've got a specialist with a specific skill set for which he would access, for which, you know, 1% or 2% of the population may need it. If you put him in a community center, then you've put a resource that is useful for 1% of the community, 2% of the community. And that's where some artificial intelligence may come in. You know, there's a little project we're working on now which looks at the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome. And carpal tunnel syndrome is probably the most common upper limb disorder in the community.
An impinged nerve in the wrist?
An impinged nerve in the wrist. So the question that we asked is, how do we enable community practitioners to diagnose carpal tunnel syndrome definitively at the point of care with minimal cost? And so there's a group that I'm working on, which is collaborating on an ultrasound machine, which you just put your hand down. The machine just goes up and down like a little Xerox copy thing. And it tells you, do you have carpal tunnel? Do you not have carpal tunnel? And we do it on the basis of artificial intelligence, because all the information needed to make the diagnosis is already available. What is necessary is for the computer to be able to read the image, extract that information, and then tell you. So I'm trying to nut through the details of the model. It's probably going to be centralized in the sense that the data acquisition occurs at the satellites, but the analysis occurs centrally. And the reason why that has to happen is for quality control. Because if centrally somebody's, and it has to be human, every single image has to have human eyes cast on it, until a point where we go, well, you know, the error rate's 1 in 5,000. Then we stand back and ask ourselves, is an error rate of 1 in 5,000 acceptable for the decision that we want to make? What are the social implications? What are the medical implications? Would we have caused more harm than good? All those sorts of decisions. But that's where artificial intelligence will come in. Artificial intelligence and orthopedics will come in decision support.
But would you agree with me also? It has everything to do with access to care and cost.
Cost, I think we can say definitively yes. Access to care, I'm not entirely convinced, because I think that social activism has a big role in terms of access to healthcare. So let's take the teddy bear doctor, right? The guy who services the, right? Now, he is one man making a difference. And other people who feel they want to make a difference on that particular day can just rock on up and make a difference. But his social activism is changing access to healthcare because it's one individual. I can name you probably four, five individuals whose social activism is changing people's access to healthcare. But you see, healthcare is a political ball. So when you get social activists playing on the healthcare playing field, it becomes a political issue. So it's always very difficult to do the right thing, because the right thing for an individual may be the wrong thing for a political purpose. Mm-hmm. The right thing medically may be the wrong thing for a social purpose. Let's take something controversial, say contraception,
yep,
and religious groups, right? So if you look at stuff like that, there's a whole bunch of activism that goes around the idea of contraception, which is exactly at opposite with the views of religious groups. So I think that's why healthcare is institutionalized. I think healthcare is institutionalized because nobody's going to come breaking down the walls, at least not in this country. Mm-hmm. But the minute you get health, so your question to me was, is it the cost? I say, yes, definitely it's part. And is it the access? I say, it's the access because who's taking it out to the community? The people taking it out, we're not talking about basic maternal and child health, which we have fantastic resources for. I mean, you know, one bidan in 5 kilometers or 15 kilometers or something like that. That level we've got absolutely correct. Now, infant mortality is fantastic. You know, the interiors of Sabah have access to basic health care. What I'm talking about is the next level, sort of when you start talking about secondary health care. A niece of mine, she's my cousin, I keep calling her niece because she's so young, right? So my young cousin is newly married, she's a doctor, and she hit her toe in the furniture around the house because she was unfamiliar with the new layout of a new house, and she works in a clinic, kesihatan. Now, she calls me up and says, oh, I think I've busted my toe, but I don't have an x-ray in my clinic, kesihatan. I have to get referred to HKL for an x-ray. Now, I'm thinking to myself, this is in the Klang Valley. In the Klang Valley, the clinic kesihatan doesn't have an x-ray machine. Many clinic kesihatans will have to refer to Hospital Kuala Lumpur. And then you wonder why the radiology department in Hospital Kuala Lumpur is like a fish market. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, how much money does it cost to put in and maintain an x-ray machine in a clinic kesihatan? I don't know. Has somebody made that decision or has somebody thought about it? I'll assume so, probably. If there was an algorithm to help people decide, does this patient need an x-ray, would that be artificial intelligence? No, that'd be real intelligence.
There's so much being said about all of this being disruptors. Mm-hmm. Do you think they're disruptors or do you think it's just common sense, which nobody really thought about before?
Well, let's go back to this young lady. So she says, Jij, since you're the ultrasound guru, can you do an ultrasound and have a look and tell me what's wrong? So I brought her to the clinic. I put a foot up. I looked at it. And by looking at it, I can already tell her what's wrong because the toe's rotated. So the angle of the nail is not the same as the angle of the other nails. And if that is the case, either a bone is broken or a joint is ruptured. Otherwise, that rotational deformity cannot exist. So that's common sense. The skill of examining in that way is common sense. So to answer your question, common sense was good enough in that particular situation. What the ultrasound did there is that it excluded the fracture. It told me which joint was ruptured. It told me the extent of the rupture. And I could give her some information to say, look, you're going to need at least 2 weeks off work. There's no way you're going to be able to stand the number of hours you need to be able to stand. And this is the particular taping you need to do. You need to twist the toe this way and then plaster it down. So to answer your question, was the 250,000, quarter of a million ringgit ultrasound machine necessary in that situation? Answer is, well, it did improve care a little bit, but common sense would have been enough to tell you what the problem was. provided you were skilled enough to see the situation.
What if it was a fracture?
What if it was a fracture? Then it would need treating. So then, because the position was malpositioned, then she would have to come in, have an anesthetic, have me pull it back in place, put a pin in it. So that would need surgery. But I just struggle a little bit with that situation going, let's amplify that situation by, you know, 1,000 going on in Selangor every day. Either there's 1,000 people waiting in HKL to have their x-ray, or there's 1,000 people walking around not adequately treated. And what disruptive technology do we have to solve the problem? You know, hands up, ultrasound. Just really, really, really disruptive. The challenges I've had in introducing it is the level of skill needed to be able to perform it adequately. Because there's no point training subspecialist radiologists in musculoskeletal ultrasound because they're not going to be out in the community. We need to train community-based people in disruptive technologies. And that's where rolling out disruptive technologies is important, because we need to empower the people who are already in the community. We need to give the community people tools and say, here's a disruptive technology. That may be the hardware part. The intelligence or the artificial intelligence is the central processing. So now, if there was some way that these 1,000 people could be scanned in the community, I could look at all the data. You know, very easy to transmit it centrally. I could look at all that data and say, well, here's what information we can distill from the data. These are the rules which I'm going to apply in this situation. And then we can send it out to the equipment again. Then the equipment can start telling the people, hey, this is what I see. It's like stethoscopes. In the old days, I feel old when I say that.
Hey, we've just come up with the first AI stethoscope, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Mm. Now, that's absolutely lovely because it goes back to the old days. In order to work out what's wrong with somebody's valves in the heart, for example, we first used to listen with the human ears and brain and the stethoscope. Then investigations came in, echocardiography and other fields came in and supplanted the stethoscope. But now, using digital technology and what it is that the human ear would have heard, it's supplanting that technology again. So to me, stuff that always goes down to the fundament and the basics will end up being the winner in the technology race, because it's simple, it's scalable, there's a lot of history behind it. So patients will come in and say, I want an MRI because it's the best investigation. My answer to which is, well, you know, MRI was only invented in the 1980s. X-ray's been around since the 1900s. So for certain medical conditions, we have far more X-ray information to make a decision rather than MR information. And people don't get that. People go, I want the best. The best is MR, so I want my MRI. Well, you can have your MRI. But is it going to be useful to make a decision? Maybe not, because the MRI gives me a lot of information, but the context of this information may not be relevant. Whereas if you had a simple X-ray, I could say, well, this is the X-ray finding. These are the reported X-ray findings from 5,000 patients over the last 100 years. So this is where you fit in the scheme. You know, we don't have that information for the MRI because we don't have that many 100 years of MRI information available. So the appropriateness of investigations is relevant, and the AI is basically to help us think about what knowledge stream we already have, what knowledge stream is easily accessible and interpretable, and what we're going to do with it.
So you've got the system in your head. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about it? I mean, you figured it out. It almost feels like common sense for you.
It is.
But it may not be for the rest of the world.
Yep. So to answer the question seriously, we are developing tools. So a group of people and I are actually developing tools where we try to put the knowledge that's in my head and in my hands into algorithms and equipment. And then we use that algorithms and equipment we tell people, you know, here's an algorithm, here's a piece of kit, use it and see what you come back with. One of the early challenges that I found is the skill level required. So say, for example, the stethoscope. The skill required of where you place the stethoscope on the chest still has to be taught. You can't just give a person this digital stethoscope and say, go. It's not that simple. You still have to train them where on the chest to place the stethoscope, as opposed to sending them for an investigation called an echocardiogram, or where they would have to go to like a specialist center with specialist equipment. So what I think the digital stethoscope will do, and what I'm aiming to do as well, is to make kit that's relatively, that can be used by allied health personnel. So the idea is, if I can make kit which is easy enough or which can be used by an allied health personnel, then it's useful. So you can train a bidan in the community on how, what the locations are to place this on a chest.
Okay. So you're going to be a disruptor in a way.
I'm trying to be a helpful disruptor.
Your message on AI and orthopedics.
It's watching you.
Thank you for joining us today. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon on artificial intelligence and orthopedics on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.